May it please the court and counsel, my name is Rick Ruffner. I represent the father appellant James Davis in this matter. As the court well knows, this is the second appeal that emanates out of a decision of a magistrate in Jefferson County in 2011. That decision was appealed to this court, and in Judge Taubman's order of April 5th, 2012, he found that there were insufficient reasons stated by the magistrate and the district court to support a deviation from child support guidelines. Judge Taubman also noted in citing the Hein case that a court's factual findings must be supported by evidence in the record. And the decision found that there were not sufficient facts at that point in the record to support a deviation from the child support guidelines. Remand was issued on May 31st, 2012, and 6.5 weeks later, a decision was issued by the district court, which is the subject matter of this appeal, in which the court stated further findings for deviation from the child support guidelines. But I assert that the reasoning in the original appeal still stands today, because the seven reasons that were stated in the July 18, 2012 decision, which is a very brief decision, simply are insufficient grounds for deviation from the child support guidelines in Colorado. But more importantly, there is not record support for the findings as made by the district court. And the district court did not hear the original evidence, simply relied upon the record itself. Let me turn to those seven reasons, because I think that's the heart of the appeal, the second appeal as well. First, in the July 18, 2012 order, the court said its reason for deviating was that the father owned substantial non-income producing assets. To a certain extent, that is correct, but it overlooks a very important fact. The assets that the father had and which he was using to liquidate and live upon were essentially the assets that the wife also received at the permanent orders hearing and still had in her possession. Father, instead of holding onto those assets, continued to liquidate them. He used those to pay his living expenses, it's not in dispute, and any other assets he had acquired since the time of the marriage were essentially in retirement accounts, IRA accounts, which he did not have at the time of the permanent orders. The court made no distinction or finding as to the impact of the wife's assets on child support in entering a deviation from the guidelines. And the district court, in following the magistrate, simply said there is non-income producing assets.
Mr. Ruffner, sure. Do you think it's a proper factor for the trial court to consider, in other words, the party's assets?
I don't, because there's case law that says, first of all, that maintenance and child support orders should not be confiscatory of the party's assets in order to meet support obligations. But more importantly, the substantial difference in assets that occurred in 2011, well, let me strike that, it wasn't substantial difference. As I point out in my brief, the assets of the parties was essentially the same, but the father had actually added somewhat to his by post-decree earnings. And those were in retirement accounts, which were not in liquid form and not able to be used for payment of any support in any of it. So no, I don't believe it was appropriate to look at that as a basis for deviation. If you do look at it, then you have to look at the entire picture, which the court didn't do. You have to look at the wife's assets, analyze those. Is it available or not to help support needs of the children, and so on. The second point that the court...
Mr. Ruffner, before you go on, my understanding is that the court does need to look at the unique circumstances of a case. So if one of the parties has liquidated and is using that in order to pay expenses, is that a proper consideration? I know a court cannot require someone to liquidate, but can they consider the fact that one has done that and is doing it?
I think you can look at that, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But the fact that a party may be liquidating assets that he or she received in impermanent orders is not a sufficient basis then for deviation from the guidelines. Quite frankly, deviation should be looking at the needs of the children primarily. And so standing alone, this substantial non-incoming producing assets owned by the father is not a proper basis for deviation from the guidelines. I do think the court can look at it. and it's a financial circumstances, as all things are financial circumstances. But this is support the guidelines and the statutory requirements for deviation. I argue that it does not.
Okay.
The second thing that the court referred to was that the father had transferred assets to his new wife. That is a red herring and really is not supported by the facts. What the father had testified to, and it was apparent from the information presented to the trial court, is that he had taken some of his First Bank stock, the bank at which he had been president, lost his job in the financial collapse, and transferred that for tax planning purposes to his new wife's name. But in his financial affidavit for this child support hearing, as well as on his statement of assets, he listed those stocks now in his new wife's name as his assets, and he also specifically included the income dividends from those assets in his income for purposes of child support. So it's a non-issue. So therefore, that's not a basis for deviation from guidelines when the very income from those assets was utilized by the court in determining the father's income. The third one is that the husband had provided false tax refund information. Again, there's absolutely no evidence that there was false tax refund information provided, with the exception that the father's initial disclosures had an unsigned tax return for the year 2010. 5 days after that disclosure, it was discovered by me that it was not a full and executed copy of the tax return. It was then determined that there was an additional tax return that was signed that did bear his wife's income information that was produced 5 days after it was discovered. It was known by the trial court at the time. It was used at the time of the hearing on modification, and so it's a non-issue. So it doesn't support a deviation from the guidelines. The fourth issue, as cited by the court, that the father had not advised the mother of his severance that he received back in 2009. Again, that's not a basis for deviation. He did testify that he had not told her when he received the severance. But by early 2010, later in 2009, the modification of support into 2010, it fully considered that severance pay and package. That's what the child support was based upon in the year 2009 and 2010. It certainly was known by the time of the modification hearing in 2011. So again, it's not a basis for deviation from the guidelines. The fifth factor that the court cited is that the father is capable of meeting his expenses. That's not a basis for deviation. It's not in the statute, it's not in case law, it's nowhere. The sixth item.
Well, Mr. Ruffner, let me just, before you get to number seven, ask you about that. My understanding is that the trial court can rely on factors that are not specified in the statute in deviating. Is that correct?
It can. And if you look at the very last sentence of the statutory section on deviation, it says that the list that it sets forth are not an exclusive, exhaustive list of the factors. So that then leaves it up to interpretation, what is an appropriate factor. I'm arguing that that's not a listed factor, and standing alone, it should not be a factor for deviation from guidelines.
But conceivably, it could.
Well, I suppose anything could be, given that last sentence in the statute. Everything is open game, but is it an appropriate reason?
Right, you're saying it shouldn't be a
factor. It should not be an appropriate reason. That's what I'm arguing.
Okay, thank you.
The sixth item cited by the court in July of 2012 is that there's a gross disparity in income of the parties. That's absolutely wrong as a matter of fact. The magistrate in his hearing in this case found that the mother, with an appropriate imputed income, actually was making more money than the father. There's no evidence whatsoever and no record support whatsoever that the father had or could have had any higher income than what was used by the trial court in the child support worksheet. And that income of the father, with the court finding that the father was making good faith efforts to find new employment, was less than the mother's. So again, there's no factual support for that reason, number six. And the seventh reason that the children have significant expenses for therapy and counseling. That would be a reason for deviation. But here, there is no record support whatsoever that the children have significant expenses. The only one mentioned by the court is therapy and counseling. The very order of the magistrate ordered that those expenses be split equally between the parties. And so that's taken out of the child support worksheets. That's paid for separate and apart from child support. There's no evidence of any other extraordinary or unusual expenses that would require deviation. And there is no support. There was no evidence submitted to show any extraordinary expenses other than, as Judge Tallman noted in the 2012 order, there was an Exhibit 11 at the trial court which did list some expenses of the children, but that exhibit was never admitted into evidence. And even if it had been, it only showed extraordinary expenses of $275 a month. It certainly is not supportive of any deviation of the guidelines of well over $1,000 a month, which is what the court did. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. If I may please the court, I'm Bill Van Horn, attorney 17092. Our attorneys in our law office practice family law exclusively. We've been doing it for many years. It's fascinating work. I'm representing the appellee mother who's here in the courtroom at the end of the table. We know that the father here is not the enemy. We wish all the best with father. He's the father of the four children, but we do want him to pay child support. The question is, how much child support should he have to pay? The father had been paying child support pursuant to a stipulation of $4,000 per month. Father filed a motion to modify child support, and then we had 2 days hearing over a two-day period in front of Magistrate John Livingston. At the end of which, the magistrate ordered that child support be $2,000 per month, which father is now paying based on a deviation from child support. So a question is, can a trial court order child support based on a deviation from the child support guidelines? Well, of course, and that's specifically in the statute at 14-10-115-8E. If a trial court orders child support deviation based on a deviation, is the court required to give written or oral findings? Yes, that's in the same statute. Did the trial court enter written findings? Yes, they did, after remand. And that's the July 18th, 2012 order that Mr. Ruffner referred to, in which District Court Judge Margie Inquist entered written orders in which she found, in part, quote, it would be inequitable, unjust, inappropriate to apply the statutory child support guidelines under these circumstances, and entered findings as to why deviation was appropriate.
Mr. Van Horn, was there a child support worksheet that would indicate what the presumptive amount of child support would be under the guidelines in this case?
Yes, there was. That was entered by Magistrate Livingston in the first order, and the amount was approximately $900 based on the child support guidelines. And that is one of the requirements that be provided, and that was done initially by Magistrate Livingston. The issues, but very briefly, was an abuse of discretion for the magistrate to enter these orders without additional evidence. We'd assert it was certainly not an abuse. There's over 1,100 pages in the record. How much more evidence do we need on that? There's an issue as to whether the record supports the ruling de novo or whether the legal standards and abuse of discretion. The stress case in our briefing certainly says that the trial court will be imperiled unless there's an abuse of discretion. So what we really have, the primary issue is what Mr. Ruffner pointed out, were the judge's findings adequate? And here I would have two primary responses. One is, do we really want to get back into the facts of the case at this point? I'll just point out an example. Mr. Ruffner did not point out all the things that the district court judge ordered. For instance, the district court found that the father is paying over $2,000 a month for his car, which is more than he's paying for child support, $450 for the golf club membership, among other findings of the court.
So, wasn't the finding also that he was taking those monies out of, he was withdrawing money from his assets to do that? Not chasing income?
He was.
And was there approximately a 50-50 asset distribution?
No, there is not. We would note that the record shows that we did not have a lot of evidence as to what the assets were because, you know, there's an argument as to how relevant that really is. It should be more on income. But for instance, the record does show father listed, he's got an $800,000 house, and he shows that the value of his furniture and household goods in the house is zero. The father way undervalued a lot of his assets, but even with that, it shows that he had substantially more assets than mother.
Well, if assets are not very relevant, you say, why should we give weight to the fact that he's taking expenses, he's withdrawing money from his assets to pay his expenses? If he chooses to, is that relevant to determining what child support should be, since that's basically income driven?
Well, I think that just points out it's income driven, and the statutory guidelines almost always apply, but what do we do under a unique, weird situation that we have here, where for the previous 3 years, the father's salary was in that 3 year period, $828,000 his salary. And then
per year's
salary was $60,000. And then the father left his job. He's offered another job at $80,000 a year, and he turns it down. So what is a court supposed to do when we're trying to figure out the statutory guidelines? Father is actually arguing that he should be found to be not underemployed, and then father actually argued that therefore if he is not underemployed, that there should be no income imputed to him. That's a whole different issue, and that that there should be no income imputed to him if he's found not to be underemployed. And so what is a judge supposed to do to compute the child support guidelines? What income are you supposed to use when father turns down an $80,000 a year job? He's made substantially more than that in the past. So,
Mr. Van Horn, did you ask the trial court to make a finding that Mr. Davis was unemployed or underemployed so that income should be imputed to him at a certain amount under the child support guidelines?
That was part of the very, very long testimony that we had. We've got over 1,100 pages of record. We did ask, I don't recall specifically whether we defined him underemployed or employed. We were essentially presenting the facts of the case, which was the father had substantial income. He was offered another job and turned it down.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because it seems to me that normally in a situation like this, if someone had gone from being bank president to being unemployed, that the trial court judge would impute income to that person based either on the amount of a job offer that he turned down or some other amount based upon what the trial court conceived was a reasonable income for that person. And so I'm just surprised that that apparently was not done here.
Your Honor, we actually did ask on recollection that his income be averaged over a period of time. There's a lot of discussion on that on the Colorado Family Law listserv as to how you impute income for someone who's no longer employed and could be employed. And so frankly, that is a difficult issue, what income would be employed.
Well, even if it's a difficult issue, it just seems to me that if that had been done, then there would have been an income for Mr. Davis, and then the child support guidelines could have been been applied based upon that imputed income?
Possibly so, but there were a very large number of other issues, and the magistrate came after more, after testimony over a two-day period, found based upon the multitude of factors, of which this is one, a very important one, but only one, that the best possible approach was to have a deviation from the child support guidelines. It would be difficult to try to determine what amount should actually be computed to follow. And we did have all these other issues there, for instance, the transfer of the father's assets to his wife.
I understood that father was contending that an income of $4,779 had been attributed to him and $5,397 for mother. Is that not correct?
Your Honor, that was based, for mother, that was based upon her salary plus dividends. For the father, it's my understanding that that was based primarily upon his dividends, and that certainly comes out to less than the $80,000 job that he was offered and turned down. And he quoted, he turned it down because he that wasn't enough money to do that. Your Honor, the second point that we really like to make is how much is enough for the judge's findings. We've got over 1,100 pages of testimony. There was no issue as to credibility. My father's asking for a new trial. Please don't put us through that. Mother can't afford it. That would be painful for everyone. That would not be good for the children. Please don't make me go through that.
Did father request a new trial? On remand, did father request a hearing?
This court ordered that the...
No, I'm asking, did father request a hearing when there was when the case was remanded?
It's my understanding that he did not. This trial court said, I'm sorry, this court of appeals said that the father could. The court said that the trial court could, in its discretion, take new evidence. The trial court went and said that she went through all the testimony again and did not take additional evidence. The final factor that I'd like to point is our judges are very, very busy out there. We were finishing the second day of hearing. Of evidence, the courtroom was filling with other people. After the judge entered his ruling, after Magistrate Livingston did that, then Mr. Upman and I both had other questions for the judge on various procedural things. Should the magistrate have entered more rulings at that point, more findings, we wish he had. The district court has since done that. But the judges are very, very busy. We try to sell everything we can, but we still end up in front of judges a lot. And there's so many pressures on the judges. There's the pro se litigants out there. There are so many factors like relocation protection orders to get priority on the schedule for the family court judges. They are now scheduling things into 2015. So please don't make the job harder for the trial court judges to find that somehow these fairly extensive findings from district court judge inquest were not adequate.
Mr. Van Horn, let me ask you this, because it seems to me from the briefing you were agreeing that maybe some of the findings did not have support in the record, but others did. And my understanding listening today is, well, something may be considered, but standing alone, it might not be enough. So I'd just like you to respond, if something standing alone is not enough, how much is enough?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's just what I tried to point out. How much is enough? We think that the district court judge entered substantial findings. How much is enough? The courts require more and more findings from a judge, for instance, the new maintenance statute. They deviate, they have to make findings there. This is making the trial court judge's job a lot more difficult. I would say that it was not that the factors were not supported in the record. The question was, does this factor by itself, would that make it appropriate to have a deviation from child support? Possibly not. But when we take all the factors together, we think that how else would this be done? We think a child support deviation was appropriate. Frankly, we were asking for a lot more money. Mother didn't have the funds to appeal it. Father does. And the father cut the child support essentially by half, and mother's willing to take it. She would have preferred more money, and the child support, of course, under much of the case law, is here for the benefit of the child, not the parent. And there's a lot of information and testimony where mother is struggling financially, and father is living large. If he's paying over $2,000 a month just for his car, I'm sure he can pay $2,000 a month in child support. And somehow, either through income or cashing in assets or something, but there's certainly funds available for the father. And prior to this hearing, the father had made an enormous amount of money, over $800,000 in salary over a three-year period, and we're not sure where that went.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Reffner, you have 3 minutes and 55 seconds.
That should be sufficient. Thank you, Your Honor. I want to respond to a couple of the questions that were asked and give a little bit more insight into that. Judge Miller, you had asked about a 50-50 property split. I believe your question was relating to the original permanent orders in the case. And yes, there was a 50-50 property split. Footnote one in my answer brief, or reply brief, I'm sorry, the reply brief, refers to that. It was approximately $910,000 in assets that both parties received at the time of permanent orders. At the time of this modification hearing, the father did have slightly more assets than the mother. Not significantly, but he did have slightly more. Approximately $200,000 more in assets than the mother. That was primarily post-decree earnings and contributions to a retirement plan, as well as things that he received as part of his severance package in 2009. You also asked about the income of $4,793 of the father. That income at the time of the 2011 hearing was primarily dividends from what First Bank stock he had remaining, or the stock that also was in his wife's name that he claimed as his income. So that was his primary source of income. He had no other meaningful income at the time, and that's important as it relates to Judge Taubman's question about, was there consideration of underemployment? There was substantial testimony at the hearing about the father's course of attempts to get employment with regard to other job availabilities, doing a startup consulting company, and so on. That was considered at length. The 80,000 job, to put that in perspective, it was a company that did not appear it was going to go anywhere, and so he chose not to get involved with a company that was going to really delay him getting back on his feet economically. The important part is that the magistrate found very clearly that the father was not underemployed. The magistrate very clearly found that the father had exercised good faith efforts to find employment. Those issues are not in dispute here. The finding of non-underemployment and the finding of good faith efforts to find employment have not been appealed. Those have been accepted. Those actually were not attacked by the district court on July 18, 2012, when the new findings were entered. So, yes, there was quite a bit of consideration of underemployment and unemployment. We knew that that would be an issue in the case for both parents, quite frankly. And the court did find that the mother was underemployed, but the father was not. And that is supported by evidence in the record, and the finding has not been contested. It was interesting to hear counsel say that income is really what counts. Well, it does. Income is really what counts. That's what the child support guidelines are all about. The deviation, even though it may create more work burden for the judges, requires the findings to deviate, because the legislature recognizes we're going above and beyond what we believe the support for these children should be given the incomes of these parents. And if you're going to deviate from a presumptive amount of support. You've got to be able to make specific findings, clear findings, and the findings must be supported by the evidence in the record. Counsel for the mother said in his argument, well, what is the court supposed to do in these unusual type of cases? First of all, I would argue that this is not an unusual case. It's a case we see week in and week out in the courts where one or the other parent has lost a job and finds themselves now without employment. But what is a court supposed to do? The court is supposed to follow the guidelines. That's why they are there. Can the court require a parent to liquidate assets? I assert that in order to pay support, I assert there's no case law for that.
Okay, thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. And the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.